heard of a true story once, and I'm not sure where I heard it or who I heard it from, but it was about a group of literature critics who met monthly to discuss various works of literature. Sometimes they would discuss long, you know, novels, sometimes poems, sometimes plays, sometimes short stories. Generally, this group did allow, and they were known to be pretty hard on what they read. They came out with a lot of negative critical, you know, comments. But sometimes they would allow individuals to submit works, you know, their pieces, to the group to for them to critique. But very few ever did this because they were known to be so harsh on their criticism. Well, one month, a young man did submit a story. Oh, and I should tell you, by the way, that they looked upon the Bible as a piece of literature, too. And one month, they critiqued it and said basically it was subpar. You know, it wasn't a very good piece of literature. And they had some fairly negative things to say about it. It wasn't bad literature, not as bad as some as they read, but it just wasn't as good as in their opinion, as what it could be. Anyway, one month, a young man did decide to submit a piece of work, piece of literature to the group, and it was only a short story, maybe about 15 pages in length. So he gave it to the members of the group, and they took it home and read it, and came back the next month. And it was amazing, the comments that they gave. Almost unanimously, they said that it was one of the most amazing pieces of literature they had ever read, this short story this young man submitted. They said the plot was a fascinating twist of events and reversals that kept the reader on the edge of their seat all the way through the story. They said there was foreshadowing in the story, and there were events that were thrilling to watch. The heroes were lovable. The villains, you just completely despised them. They said, in short, this was one of the best stories this group has ever read. So they asked the young man, you know, where did you get this idea? How did you come up with this great story? He told them, to their shock and amazement, that he hadn't come up with it. He'd pulled the story straight out of the Bible that they had previously criticized. And so that they wouldn't recognize it, he just changed the names, and that's all he did. What was the story? You guessed it. The story of Esther. True story about those literature critics. So today does begin our series through the book of Esther. I encourage you to turn there if you haven't already. Book of Esther. It comes, maybe some of you remember last week, we kind of did the broad overview picture of the Bible. And I do have a couple extra copies of those handouts if anyone would like to pick up a few of those for their personal reference or for friends or relatives or neighbors or something. So the book of Esther, though, comes right at the end of historical books. If you found Ezra and Nehemiah, then we have Esther. It comes right before the poetical books. And the poetical books, so it's right before Job, Psalms, Proverbs, etc. And so the book of Esther is sandwiched right between the middle. And it's the most amazing book ever. It's in the most amazing book ever written. The Bible, if you remember, is the number one bestseller of all time. So as you're turning there, though, to the book of Esther, I want to give you a little bit of background to the book. And I want to do so by asking you a question. I want to ask you a question. The question is, have you ever wondered, where is God? You know, maybe you're going through a real difficult time in your life, and you're like, God, where are you? Or, God, what are you doing? In fact, there's a book out there called Where is God When It Hurts? You know, when you're going through depression or times of trials or sickness, have you ever asked, God, where are you? Where is God? Has it ever seemed to you that maybe God is too distant or too busy to hear your prayers? Maybe too busy to be concerned with you in your life? Have you ever wondered if God is really out there? Have you ever wondered why he doesn't reveal himself more clearly? You read in Acts and in the Gospels and in Exodus and Genesis these miraculous, spectacular things he was doing and say, God, how come you don't do those things today? Have you ever wondered that? Have you ever wondered where he is when everything seems to be going wrong? Well, the book of Esther answers that exact question, but in a way that you will never imagine. It's amazing. And rather than keep you in suspense to the end of the book to how the book of Esther does this, I'm going to tell you right now, God is not in the book of Esther. What do I mean by that? Not one time do we see the word God in the book of Esther. He's not named. He's not there, at least not on the surface. On top of that, we never see any mention of worship or faith. There's no prediction of the Messiah like every other Old Testament book has. There is no mention of heaven or hell. We do not even see anyone praying in the book of Esther. It seems to be a completely non-religious book. And we do see some people fasting, we'll see that, but there's not the prayer that normally accompanies fasting. We don't see the prayer. So it's surprising, you know, some people say, well, why is Esther even in our Bible? It has nothing to do with God. In fact, Martin Luther, okay, he wrote this. He didn't want Esther in the Bible. He said, I am so hostile to 2 Maccabees and to Esther, 2 Maccabees is not in this Bible, that I could wish they did not exist at all. For they Judaize too greatly and have much pagan impropriety. Basically, he's saying, I don't want this book in our Bible. Why is the book of Esther in our Bibles? Well, I think a verse out of the New Testament can summarize the book of Esther quite well. It's Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. We're going to see that in the book of Esther. God is at work in all things for the good of those who love him and who have been called according to his purposes, even when we can't see him. In fact, just so you know, the name Esther tells us that this is going to happen. The name Esther, the name of the book, implies this. Some think, by the way, Esther is her Persian name. We're going to see why. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah. There's a little Bible trivia for you. Hadassah. She was changed her name to Esther. Some believe she was named after the Persian god of love, which was Ishtar. But we have a scholar by the name of Jacinius. He's one of the greatest Hebrew authorities. He says that the name Esther is derived from the Hebrew word meaning to hide. To hide. Therefore, he says, Esther means something hidden. Something hidden. And in the book of Esther, we're going to see there is so much hidden information. There are certain key pieces of information that we know, but the characters of the story do not. They're hidden information, pieces of hidden information. And all of this comes together for the most spectacular ending that most books in the Bible, more spectacular than most books of the Bible have. But the biggest piece of hidden information in the whole book is, of course, God. He's behind the scenes. There's always more in the works than any individual is aware of. So, even when God is not so obvious, we see God everywhere. And it's just like this. That was a perfect film, Steve, this morning, because there was this young man, this is another story, there's this young man who was searching for God. You know, people do this sometimes. They set out to try and find God. And he heard of this deeply religious man who claimed, or who it was said to have he had a great relationship with God, just really good fellowship with God. So he goes, I'm going to go talk to this guy and find out if he can tell me where God is. So he went, and he says, Sir, I want to see God. I have searched for him and cannot find him. Can you show him to me? Well, the old man looked at the young man a moment, and then he raised his eyes up to the trees. Just imagine the scenes we saw in this video this morning. He raised his eyes up to the trees and saw the leaves rustling in the wind and the seeds. And beyond that, he saw the glowing sun in the blue sky, birds soaring through the air. He looked across the field and saw children playing some sort of game. Then he looked back at the young man and said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Young man became angry. Why not? Don't you know how I can see God, how I can find God? The old man patiently responded, The reason I cannot help you see God is because I see him everywhere I look. I do not understand how you miss him. If you cannot see him anywhere, I can't help you. That's the way it is going to be in Esther. Some people don't see God. Some people see him everywhere. It all depends on your perspective, even though he's not mentioned even one time. So when you ask, where is God? The author of Esther says, God is everywhere and has his hands in everything. God, it is true, has exercised his sovereignty in the past through this spectacular events, like the parting of the Red Sea, creation, pillars of fire, You know, he's on the front stage, he's in the spotlight, wonders and miracles, walls of Jericho falling down. But he's also exercised his sovereignty from behind the curtain. He does not only work in showmanship and on the center ring. He's in the business of miracles even when they're not flashy. He can work as much through circumstances and human events as he can through water from a rock or a pillar of fire. The complete absence of God from the text is the genius of the book. So, where is God? Esther says, if you have to ask, you've already missed him. At the time of Esther, that question, where is God, was the exact question the people of Israel were asking. It was one of their most important questions they were asking. Let me review for you what was going on in the book of Esther, just for the sake of review, so we can understand the book of Esther when we look at it here, first chapter, real briefly. As you may remember from last time, God set up a royal line through King David. And David's son, Solomon, ruled after him. Now, the reign of Solomon was the golden age of Israel. It was peace and prosperity, and everyone was wealthy and happy and healthy. But after Solomon, things got bad. Maybe you remember, the nation couldn't decide who they wanted to be king after Solomon. Solomon's son or this other guy, let's see, Rehoboam or Jeroboam, I get the two mixed up. But so what happened is the nation split. The 10 northern tribes wanted one king, the 2 southern tribes wanted the other, and so they split, kind of like what happened in our Civil War, and they were now enemies against each other, and the northern and the southern kingdoms. Well, roughly 200 years after this division, the northern 10 tribes, because they had completely evil kings, God said, that's enough, you're carried off into judgment. And they went off, Assyria came and conquered them, and they went off into captivity. And we never heard from them again. But the southern 2 tribes, they had some good kings and some bad ones, but they lasted about 400 years. But finally, you know, they got too evil and too wicked, and so God said, enough. And the Babylonians came and carried them off into captivity. And you can read a little bit about that in the book of Daniel. Maybe you remember that Daniel understood from the prophet Jeremiah that their captivity would last only 70 years. Daniel was alive during, I think, all of that time, all of that 70 years. Remember, Daniel prophesied about the 4 beasts. The first one was Babylon, which carried them off to captivity. The second beast was Medo-Persia, which we're going to see in the book of Esther. Third beast is Greece, and the fourth beast is Rome, which was ruling at the time of Christ. So, Daniel saw all this come to life during his lifetime. He was alive when the Babylonian Empire fell to Persia, the second beast. And Persia, under the rule of Cyrus, you can read about Cyrus prophesied in the book of Isaiah, Cyrus decided for many different reasons to allow Israel to return to their homeland and rebuild the temple. Now that happened in 536 BC and fulfilled what Daniel had seen about the 70-year captivity. So a group of Israelites, about 50,000 of them, we don't know how many millions of Israelites there were, but only about 50,000 of them returned under the leadership of a man named Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple. They ran into complications. About halfway through building the temple, they quit, and it took them 60 years to finish. And it wasn't finished until Ezra arrived about 60 years later and said, hey, let's get going here. And you can read Haggai and Zechariah and their prophets who are saying, quit living in your houses and having your nice jobs and let's get this temple built because God needs a place to dwell too. So later after Ezra, Nehemiah comes with the people to rebuild Jerusalem and the walls. Okay, so during that 60-year time span, okay, the temple is half built, not yet built, that's when Esther falls. During that 60-year gap, when the temple is not yet built, that's when Esther takes place. Now, there are some who think that we should read the book of Esther as a book of judgment on all those Israelites who didn't return. They see that God commanded Israel to return, and that some of these Israelites didn't. And so they see that, well, Esther is a book about, you know, we should see it as she's sinning, and Mordecai is sinning because they didn't return. But I think that this is wrong, actually. Let me just read what one commentator said. Here's what he said. Here is a woman who is willing to stay in Persia and sleep with a heathen king rather than to return to Israel and become the wife of a godly Israelite. She is a schemer and a manipulator. She has learned well from her uncle Mordecai, who refuses to show honor and respect to those in authority. That's what he said. And he interprets the whole book of Esther in that light. Now, I think that approach is wrong. In fact, I think it is judgmental and maybe a little bit legalistic, which is sometimes what Christians are known as. Was Esther sinning? Well, maybe she was. Maybe she should have returned. Maybe Mordecai should have as well. And, you know, she did intermarry with another race, which is what God commanded them not to. But I don't think that that is the point of the story. In fact, we see no statement here in Esther or anywhere else in the Bible that they were condemned for what they were doing. The fact of the matter is God had a plan and needed them right where they were, in Persia. And I want to show you more detail later, but just real briefly today why this is so. I think that the point of the story is to show that God is always working behind the scenes. Let me show you why. We know from history that Esther married the king of Persia, right? Well, he had another son by another wife previously, and that son was the king who made the decree that allowed all the Israelites to return and rebuild the walls and the city of Jerusalem. Maybe the plan was that God placed Esther in her place, not only to save the whole Israelite nation, as we're going to see, but also to send them back to Israel so that Jerusalem could be restored. If Mordecai and Esther had gone, none of that would have happened. So it is Esther's stepson that signs the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. In fact, this fulfills Daniel 9:26, the fulfilled prophecy. Here's what Daniel 9:26 says. From the issuing of the decree to rebuild and restore Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, that's Christ, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. So that prophecy brought about because Esther was the wife of the king, ultimately allowed the coming of the Messiah. Therefore, to say that the book of Esther is written to condemn Esther and Mordecai and the Israelites who remained behind, I think, is wrongheaded and misunderstood. In fact, if they were living in sinful rebellion against God, throughout the Old Testament, we see that God condemns them and judges them and puts them to death. And we see the exact opposite in the book of Esther. He blesses them and keeps them alive and allows them to glorify Him because of His work. So, let's look now. That's what the background behind us, the introduction, the background, the historical background. I want to look today at chapter 1 of Esther. Chapter 1, verse 1. You should all be there. And I'm reading from the New International Version. Esther 1:1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. Okay, stop there. And some of your translations, if you have the King James or maybe the NAS, might say Ahasuerus. This is what happened during the time of Ahasuerus. Now, that is what is in the original Hebrew, in case you're wondering. The reason the NIV says Xerxes is because Xerxes is a name, while Ahasuerus is a title. It's like Caesar or king or president or pharaoh. And there are three people in Scripture who have the title of Ahasuerus. There's the father of Darius the Mede. You can read about him in Daniel 9:1. There's a king mentioned in Ezra 4:6. And there's this king here in Esther, whom we also know from history as Xerxes. So to avoid confusion, the NIV has just changed the names here and say, well, this is Xerxes. This is Ahasuerus Xerxes, you know, King Xerxes. And he reigned for 21 years, we know that, over the 127 provinces we see here in this verse. And basically that 127 provinces thing is just saying, you know, he has absolute and unlimited power. And that's going to be important. We know where India is, and Kush, in case you're curious, is northern Africa. All right, verse 2. At that time, King Xerxes, Ahasuerus, reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. Now, if you have the King James Version, it says Shushan. It's basically the same thing, just different names for the same city. It was a large city about 200 miles east of Babylon. It was the winter residence of Persian kings. It's where they went in the winter. Now, archaeologists have found this city and uncovered the site and have found many of the things we read about in this book. This is amazing. They found, we're going to see in 4:2, the King's Gate. They found that and identified it. Also the inner court, which we'll see in 5:1, the outer court, which we'll see in 6:4, the palace garden, which we'll see in 7:7. Get this, they've even found a set of dice, which we're going to see in 3:7, was used to cast the lot to determine which day to slaughter the Israelites. They found some dice. Might not be the same ones, but they found them. And so that's pretty amazing. They called them pure, by the way. We'll see how that plays in as well. Verse 3, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. 180 days. Now that's a party. 180 days, half a year. Xerxes was known historically for his drinking parties. He was also known for his fits of rage, which we're going to see in just a little bit. Also, we learn from this verse that at his castle, citadel in Susa, he had a large harem. Now, this banquet he was hosting was actually a banquet to prepare for an expedition against Greece. Sources suggest that he wanted to avenge his father's defeat at the Battle of Marathon. We've all heard of that battle, Marathon, near Athens. Now this, basically, it's an elaborate pep rally he's doing here, trying to get the military leaders and princes and nobles to support him with soldiers, food, supplies, money, so that he can go on this military campaign. And according to the historian Herodotus, it took Xerxes nearly 4 years to get ready for this invasion. He launched it in 481. Herodotus claims that he gathered an army of almost 5 million men. Other sources say that's probably a little bit of an exaggeration. It was probably closer to 1 to 2 million men. So part of this 180 days is spent planning for that war, which he plans to go on against Greece. Now, we're going to see all that plays in next week, but I want to tell you right now, he suffered an enormous defeat. He took 1 to 2 million men, came back with less than 5,000. Isn't that amazing? Only 5,000 return. He had to retreat home. It was disastrous. And we're going to see how that plays in next week in chapter 2. Verse 5, when these days were over, the king gave a banquet, lasting 7 days, in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. So here's another banquet. The other one was 180 days. This one's 7 days. The other one was for all the people of the 127 provinces, all the military leaders, princes, and nobles. This one's just for the people of Susa, just the people who live there in the citadel of Susa. Verse 6, he's going to describe the garden where the party was. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver bells on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. See the elaborate descriptions? Now these are descriptions that are going to make a Better Homes and Garden reader weep. Verse 7, wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. Verse 8, by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. And we think, what's going on? Normally, the guests drank as the king drank. If he stayed sober, so would they. If he got drunk, so would they. But here we see the king saying, hey, drink however you want, and it doesn't matter. You can drink as much or as little as you want. Verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the woman in the royal palace of King Xerxes. So here we're introduced to Queen Vashti. And some sources suggest, they're not too reliable, but maybe possibly she was the granddaughter of King Nebuchadnezzar, who again you can read about in the histories in your Old Testament. We see in verse 9 that she's also giving her own party for the woman. Normally the men and women had separate parties, men in one, women in another. I don't know why. But we see it happening here. Notice also, this is important, the complete lack of description that the author gives Queen Vashti's party. King Xerxes, he had this elaborate, you know, the pillars and the gold and the couches and the marble and the mother of pearl and the costly stones and royal wine. But this is all we get for Queen Vashti. She also gave a banquet. That's important. We'll see why. And we're going to see that how this reveals the pomp and the power that the king reveled in and how it sets him up for the complete foolishness that he wallowed in. Wealth does not guarantee wisdom. And verse 9 also talks about the royal woman. Now, the royal woman of the palace most likely were other members of the harem. There's also maybe some nobility there, but most likely other members of the harem. And it's kind of ironic, but Persian kings believed in monogamy. They believed that you could only have one wife. And you think, what? So what they do is they marry one wife and then gather a huge harem. And they're monogamous. One wife. They still only had one wife. That's how they got around it. It's a little bit like today. Our culture condemns polygamists. Maybe you've been seeing in the Interlake, there's this trial going on down in Utah where this man, he has five wives and over like 25 children. He's on trial for, I'm not quite sure what, maybe a law against polygamy or something. But our culture condemns polygamists. But how do we get around it? You know, we believe one man, one wife. Well, our culture rarely sees anything wrong with sleeping around before marriage, right? That's okay. Even after marriage. If you don't like your wife or your husband, your spouse, well, you can divorce him and get another one. Or sleep around, and just as long as you stay married, that's fine too. That's the way we get around it today, kind of like King Xerxes did. But let's move on. Verse 10. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine. Some of your translations say, merry with wine. Today we might say he was wasted. Literally. In that time, Herodotus, the historian again, tells us that the Persians drank as they discussed matters of state. Why? They believed that intoxication put them closer to the spiritual world. In fact, here's what he said. It is the Persian custom to deliberate about the gravest matters when they are drunk. And what they approve in their councils is proposed to them the next day by the master of the house where they deliberate when they are now sober. And if being sober, they still approve it, they act thereon. But if not, they cast it aside. And when they have taken counsel about the matter when sober, they decide upon it when they are drunk. So they don't make a decision without somewhere in the process getting drunk. And I was reading this, and I thought, well, that's a unique way to do government. But then I thought, well, I wonder if it's better or worse than ours. We take so long to make a decision. Probably the decisions they made when drunk were rather quick. They don't talk about it. Maybe they argue a little bit, but then it's done. And then I thought, well, on the other hand, I don't know if the decisions made when drunk would be good decisions. So I think still we probably are better off. Anyway, the king is drunk, continuing in verse 10. He commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass. Now, the eunuchs were the ones who served him in the harem. In case you didn't know, a eunuch is a castrated male. That way, he cannot interfere with the woman in the harem or have children, because then they might try and take over the throne. There's a bunch of different reasons. Herodotus also tells us that in general, eunuchs were cringing, fawning leeches who often just told the king what they thought he wanted to hear. Okay, verse 11, we see the tension building here. He tells the eunuchs, verse 11, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. Now, there are some commentators who think that he was commanding her to appear in nothing but her royal crown. Okay, in nothing but her royal crown. Probably that is not the case. There is nothing immoral or lewd going on here. She was summoned to display her royal beauty, not to entertain the troops with some sensual display. Verse 12. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, we're going to see what happens, Queen Vashti refused to come. The reason she did not come is because it was considered shameful to show her faces to the masses. Barbara saw this in Africa, I'm sure. When she went out, she went veiled, just her eyes showing. The king was trying to show off her face, not her body, her face. He wanted her to come out with her royal crown and her face showing to show her beauty. And this would be undignified and beneath her station as queen, and so she refused. Now really, she couldn't do anything else. If she went, she would be scorned and shamed by all who saw her, especially the other ladies of the royal court, because they have never shown their face to the masses, and here the queen had. If she didn't go, as we see happen here, well, she's placing herself at the mercy of the king, and we'll see what he does. And so she's basically being modest. Women, remember that the modesty is the crown jewel of womanhood, like we see Queen Vashti here. So let's see what he does. Verse 12, then the king became furious and burned with anger. He's humiliated because his wife will not obey him. It's really ironic. Here he is trying to get support for his war. He cannot even get his own wife to obey him. He's a king with all of his wealth and his power and his friends, but he cannot even get his own wife to obey him. I really think the author is trying to get us to laugh here at the king, the king's dilemma. Anyway, in response to Vashti's refusal, he flies into one of his famous fits of rage. Before, he's merry with wine. Now, he's mad. And that's the way it is with getting drunk. You lose control of your emotions. One person can be all happy one second, and 2 seconds later be furious mad, steaming mad. It's just in the span of a few seconds. So let's see what he does in his drunken rage. Verse 13. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matter of the law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times. They were closest to the king: Karshina, Shetha, Admatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marsina, and Memucan, the 7 nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. Verse 15. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes. The eunuchs have taken to her. Now, we saw before the great detail of his banquet. Notice now the great detail that the author gives to the king's advisors. It's sarcasm dripping from the pages almost. They are experts in matters of the law. They understood the times. They had special access to the king, and they were highest in the kingdom, is what he says. Now, with all that, watch how foolishly they act. Verse 16. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, "Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes." Memucan speaks up, and right away he's making a mountain out of a molehill. What began as an issue between two people, husband and wife, is now elevated to an empire-wide crisis. Verse 17, for the queen's conduct, Memucan is continuing here, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the people, and so they will despise their husbands and say, "Queen Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come." Verse 18, this very day the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. They're afraid of a women's liberation movement. This advisor, he's basically saying, she's a threat to the social structure of our society. Reality, she's only a threat to a proud and petty, power-hungry king. So what does Memucan propose? We see it in verse 19. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal petition to someone who is better than she. So basically, she's demoted within the harem. Notice she's not called upon to defend herself, nor is anyone allowed to defend her. As Christians, we are called to defend those who cannot defend themselves or are not allowed to defend themselves. So the result is that she's removed from her position as queen. She remains within the harem, but just not as queen. This, by the way, is not according to biblical standards or guidelines. Men, these are not instructions on how to treat your wives. So Memucan continues in verse 20. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. What he is saying is, we can't have this. If we let Vashti get away with this and it becomes known, well, the whole empire, women will want to treat their husbands this way. So ironically, the king ends up publicizing his embarrassing plight by ordering throughout the empire what he himself could not accomplish in his own palace. Their decision to demand honor from their wives by an empire-wide edict would have actually achieved the exact opposite of what they wanted. They wanted to, you know, kind of keep it under the cover and make sure women respected their husbands. And so what do? They let the whole empire know that the queen did not respect her husband, at least from his point of view. Exactly what they did accomplished exactly the opposite of what they wanted. So it's really quite laughable. Verse 21, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, probably because they were drunk. So the king did as Memucan proposed. Verse 22, he sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. decree is they did it by Pony Express then, really. They did. They had a Pony Express system much like ours in our frontier days. And again, Herodotus says that neither snow, rain, heat, nor darkness deterred the messengers. Sounds a lot like our postal slogan, through rain, hail, sleet, or snow. They developed that system. And we see that the edict was taken everywhere into all languages. In fact, he's very clear, the author is, all language, each people's own script, and each people's own tongue. So make sure everyone hears about this. And that's how chapter 1 ends. The plot is set up. We've got a proud king. We've got a deposed queen. We have a national law. We've seen the leadership of the proud and the powerful. And we will soon see their fall at the hands of an Israelite woman. We've seen that despite their wealth and power, they really were quite foolish and petty. And of course, that's one of the worst combinations, isn't it? Power in the hands of a fool. You see that in Proverbs. In such cases, a nation is in real danger. It's ruled by the pride and the arrogance of buffoons whose egos command the national laws and power for their own selfish and childish causes. We've seen it happen far too often. In fact, we've seen this happen in history over and over. I'm sure the names of Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin bring to mind terrors created by unchecked power. Even our own country, we've seen leaders who fall into the temptations of power. Presidents fall into money and sex scandals. Big business corporations exploit their workers. They manipulate their customers. We've even seen price gouging recently. You know, Christians are not immune to this either. We've seen churches and denominations abuse their power. We've seen church leaders fall to power's siren song. Even in family relationships, we all have power to some degree, don't we? Husbands, you know, they misinterpret Ephesians 5 and think that that gives them the right to abuse their wives, speak negatively to them. Or parents sometimes abuse their children. Power and the misuse of power. It's such an issue today. Now, where do you have power? Are you lording it over those below you? Do you do things sometimes just because you can, not caring how it affects those under you? Whether a husband or wife in the privacy of our homes, or as a spiritual leader in the church, as a CEO of a large corporation, or a manager of a business, head of state in the state or country or county even, city, we are responsible to resist the temptations of power for the satisfaction of ungodly pride and lust in any of its forms. We've seen it happen today to King Xerxes and how he fell, and we're going to see the results in the weeks to come. And I hope you will join us as we learn the lessons of this wonderful book. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for this wonderful testimony from the book of Esther. And just today in chapter 1, we see the lessons of power and the temptations that comes with it, Father. We pray that each of us, in our own areas of power, that you would grant us the strength to keep ourselves from the temptations that come with it and the pride that comes with it and even the pettiness things, the way we can act so petty at the expense of others because of our pride and our position. And we pray all this. We thank you for this wonderful lessons today. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.